Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll get the latest on big changes taking place at Valley Children's Hospital. They've returned to their old name and are also launching a new healthcare network that expands to Kern County. But there's even more changes on the horizon. We'll talk to the hospital's CEO and also find out about the ongoing tensions between Children's and a local physicians group that's left some people shut out from their doctors. We'll also find out why dairies are leaving the Central Valley and the Golden State in general for the Midwest, and why it's big business for those in Nebraska and South Dakota. That and a special musical treat as jazz and world music mandolinist Eva Scow will join us for a live in-studio performance ahead of her Crescent concert that's coming up in just a few days. But right now we turn to a very special story for this time of year. But in truth, it would be relevant in any season, because it's about our veterans returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan and the challenges they face in readjusting on the home front. Among that group are women who may have a hard time making that transition, sometimes even ending up on the verge of being homeless. As part of our series Common Threads, Veterans Still Fighting the War, FM 89's Diana Aguilera reports on how one Fresno woman is determined to make a difference.
Anita Pascual always looks forward to Monday nights. It's the time when she gets to sit on a couch and chat with other women.
I made coffee. Do you guys still want coffee?
The group of 10 are sitting in the living room, drinking something warm for this chilly night. With all the laughing that's going on, one would think it's a ladies' night. But in reality, Pascual is on the clock, trying to connect these women with jobs.
CarMax is looking for 15 sales consultants, so they're looking to hire people like as soon as possible.
She's there to help these women, who all have two things in common. They were all homeless and veterans. Pascual works for Homefront, a project of the nonprofit organization Westcare Foundation. The program gives women veterans in Fresno County a temporary home and a support network so they can get back on their feet.
So, does anybody have anything new, exciting information?
I got my voucher today.
Yay!
Pascual isn't a stranger to these women. That's because at one point she was in the same situation, a veteran with no place to call home. The 30-year-old started her journey in the military, training as a truck driver with the National Guard. She was just 19 years old when she joined so she could get help to pay for school. But her life took an unexpected turn.
The Friday I found out I was pregnant, the next day, which is Saturday, I had my drill and I found out we were getting activated to go to Iraq.
Pascual didn't make it overseas. Since she was pregnant, she decided to get out of the National Guard. But 3 years later, she returned, this time leaving her three children to join the Army. In 2009, she left for Afghanistan.
Just the flight over when they tell you, okay, we're going to go blackout, and you're like, what, you know, and they're like, we're going to do a nosedive, and they literally shut everything off, engines and everything, and they just dive down. It was scary. Like, you just don't know what to expect. If you haven't done it already, then you don't know. And I'm pretty sure if you have done it, you still don't know.
She says there was something powerful about getting behind the wheel of a big MRAP.
From my circle of people that I knew outside of there, a lot of them hadn't done anything like that before, you know? Like, I mean, yeah, probably sucks. I had my moments where I was like, oh my gosh, dude, I almost flipped the truck over, you know, like that would have been very bad. But I still think it was all worth it and it was good.
That's exactly why she went back to serve her country. She wanted to expand her comfort zone and find some stability.
There's just a lot going on in my life at the time that I was just dealing with. So rather than staying home and sulking, I can get on and do something productive.
After serving overseas for 11 months, she says she felt like she was on top of the world, like she could conquer anything that life threw her way. But a few months after she went back home to Fresno, she hit rock bottom.
I had to get used to paying my bills on time and doing all this stuff, and I couldn't, and those things happened, like, and snowballed, and the next thing I knew, like, I was getting evicted and I had nowhere to go.
She says it was tough to readjust to civilian life.
One day I was me and, you know, a soldier and this and that, and the next day I'm mom again. mom and sister and daughter, and I had to do all that back alone. And it was exhausting and overwhelming sometimes.
Pasquale went from feeling like a proud soldier to almost being homeless just a few months later. That's when someone told her about Homefront.
I was able to pick myself up here. I was able to get support in different areas and get a job again and get back into school and connect with my kids.
It's been nearly 4 years since she got out of the apartments and left the program. She got married and lives with her husband and kids in a home in Fresno. Now, the 30-year-old says working with homeless women veterans and helping them find the support they need has been her true calling.
Since I've been back, I know that I wanted to work with veterans at some capacity. Now I'm able to. And then in this specific location inside, like, it's just that much more closer to home for me.
One of the ladies living there is Elle, who did not want us to use her last name. Pasquale wants to help Elle get back on track, just like she did a few years ago. Elle says this program has inspired her to believe that one day she will get back on her feet.
It's not just a room and that's it. You have all the capabilities of what can help you to move forward. It doesn't make you feel like you're sitting under a park bench anymore.
She's been living in the apartments provided by the program for about 2 months, and she says meeting Pasquale has changed her life.
I'm going to get my college benefits. She put me up with a good position with being able to get a job. Eight years of back and forth. It took 7 weeks just for Anita to help me out.
Back at Homefront, Pasquale gives me a tour of the apartments near the train tracks in southwest Fresno. It's in a rough neighborhood, but driving by, you can tell the pride the residents have in their homes.
How our sites look, you know, the ladies are here, everyone has like a job and a chore to do. So they maintain all of these, the lawn and sprinkler system, just all the facility.
As we walk around the apartment complex, she says she never thought she would be back in the same place where she was able to pick herself up. But when the opportunity to work there came along earlier this year, she took it. And now she says her job means so much to her because she's been through that experience herself.
It's fulfilling, and it's like I feel like I can understand. You know, I might not know exactly, but I know what it is to struggle in this capacity. That can go up from here. I know if you set your mind to it, I know you can.
Today, in addition to her job at Homefront, Pasquale is going to school at the University of Phoenix in Fresno. She hopes to graduate with a degree in social work next December. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Diana Aguilera.
Hard times coming home now. Can't get your feet on the ground.
This report is the third in our series called Common Threats, Veterans Still Fighting the War, telling the story of Valley veterans and the challenges they've faced on the home front. It's made possible in part with support from Cal Humanities and the War Comes Home initiative. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
And everyone else is carrying on just like they've always done before. You've been home for a couple of years now, buddy, but you're still fighting the war.
We hope you enjoyed that story about Valley veterans. You can find more of those on our website at kvpr.org. Moving on with our show, California is the nation's number one dairy state. It's branded as the state with happy cows, but not necessarily happy dairy owners. For many of them, it's getting tougher and tougher to make a living. That's why some are selling their cattle and heading to the Midwest. FM89's Ezra David Romero brings us this first in a two-part report, in a collaboration between Valley Public Radio and the Midwest-based Harvest Public Media.
Brian Acevedo's done. He's done with California, the state he's called home for the entirety of his 26 years.
We realized that we could not stay here. Like, it is not viable.
Acevedo's a Portuguese-American dairy farmer in Merced, California. He, his parents, his brother, and sister have milked cows for 15 years. They rented a dairy with a herd of 600 and constantly dreamt of owning their own. But that dream has been hard to catch.
The cost of feeds here, exacerbated by the drought, as well as constant increasing in regulation, and the cost of those regulations have made it very difficult for a small operation like ourselves.
And the Acevedos aren't alone in the struggle dairymen face in California. Michael Marsh, the CEO of Western United Dairymen, says a full quarter of the state's dairies have closed since 2007.
They've just closed their doors, and they've decided to make their investment in other states.
He blames high feed costs, state and business environmental regulations, and the drought. He also blames almonds, The large demand and high profit margin for the nut has some dairymen leveling their operations and planting almond orchards.
As the dairy farmers have transitioned out of that business, some other permanent crop has come in to take the position where the dairy was.
Azevedo, the dairy farmer in Merced, wanted to give up his dairy farm, but didn't want to give up dairy farming.
I'm willing to talk to anybody and everybody.
That's David Skaggs. He works for South Dakota, luring dairies to the state. Skaggs met the Azevedos at the World Ag Expo in Tulare, California. The dairy pavilion there is full of recruiters from the Midwest, Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, all vying for the attention of dairy farmers.
We have dairies that have relocated from Ireland, England, the Netherlands, numerous other states as well, but California seems to be a good target market for us.
South Dakota recruits so hard that the state's governor, Dennis Dugard, is involved in the recruiting. The state even uses a hashtag, GetSomeMilk2014. Dugard spoke with AgNetWest.com at last year's expo.
We're trying to attract California dairymen to look at South Dakota's advantages for establishing a dairy.
South Dakota's message is this. The state has fewer regulations, processes permits quickly, has ample amount of land, and has plenty of cheese and milk processors.
Not only is the regulatory climate good, but the economics are very good. We don't have any personal income tax. We have no corporate income tax. Feed costs are low, and our milk prices are high.
Skaggs' goal is to double the number of dairy cows in the state.
Since I took over in 2005, we have grown our dairy industry from 81,000 dairy cows to 97,000 today. By the end of the year, we'll be over 100,000 cows.
Azevedo was hooked. He sold most of his cows, made multiple trips to South Dakota, and eventually bought a 117-acre dairy in the Mount Rushmore state for less than $1 million. It would have cost him at least twice as much in California. Every morning, Azevedo wakes up, grabs a pitchfork, and feeds the 60 cows he decided to keep with a hay, oat, and corn mix.
I'd much rather leave my home and go where I can have a dairy business and have cows do what I want to do versus stay here where I'm at and do something else. I think that I'll be happier over there versus being over here in better weather doing what I don't want to do.
And come mid-spring, the Azevedos will settle in South Dakota, leaving behind California's dairy world for what he hopes will be greener pastures. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
That story is the first of two in a joint reporting project between Valley Public Radio and the Midwest-based Harvest Public Media. Of course, it's not just about California dairies looking for greener pastures. States in the Midwest, like Nebraska, Kansas, and Iowa, are pitching themselves as dairy heaven. For the Midwest, an influx of dairies isn't just about milk. It's about pumping dollars into the rural economy. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach has the story.
Here's why you should move your dairy to Nebraska.
We have ample land. We have ample clean water because we live above an underground lake called the aquifer.
Willow Hollebeck is the executive director of AFAN, the Alliance for the Future of Agriculture in Nebraska.
That also means that we have a very stable feed supply because we are the number one irrigated state in the nation.
Hollebeck is one of Nebraska's primary dairy recruiters. Like ag officials from other Midwest states, Hollebeck has been going to big farm shows, pitching Nebraska as a dairy destination. California is ripe recruiting ground.
Dairymen in California are being surrounded by population. The price of land or development is high, and so they are really kind of landlocked.
So when you talk about a place with lots of water and open spaces, it gets the attention of dairy farmers like Marty DeHogue.
Connor, come from California, 6115, 1806. I bought from my buddy in Texas, 5469. They came from California.
DeHogue moved his dairy 1,400 miles from Southern California to Eastern Nebraska last summer. He's walking me through one of his barns near the town of Seward. There are 500 black and white Holsteins on the farm, but he seems to know each one by the number on its yellow ear tag.
I wrote every single ear tag in here, so I tagged her when she was a day old, you know, born the day she was born, so.
DeHogue is a third-generation dairy producer from the Chino Valley east of Los Angeles. Over 70 years, his family built a dairy business in what he says was once one of the most dairy-rich areas in the country.
Like our block in Southern California, there are six dairies on 160 acres. There was 4,000 milk cows on 160 acres.
So why would he uproot his family to move halfway across the U.S.? A big reason is the valley that used to be dairy country is quickly becoming part of the city.
Now within a mile, there's brand new housing tracts, and they're putting 7-8 houses per acre. You know, they're just It's the only piece of open dirt available to build on between L.A. and Barstow, pretty much.
That creates other challenges. Feed for the animals has to be shipped in, making it more expensive. Manure has to be trucked out, sometimes up to 70 miles, so it can be spread on farm fields as fertilizer. DeHoag started shopping around for a new home. He looked at Idaho, Texas, and Colorado, but eventually settled on Nebraska. He's renting the dairy right now, but after the family property is sold out west, he wants to build a new farm, and that would mark a big economic investment for Nebraska. Jeff Kuhn is a retired dairy specialist with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
Okay, just in the construction costs of building a new dairy, which would go right into the local community, we're talking about $5,000 to $7,000 a cow.
So, for example, it would take $14 to $15 million to build a new 2,000-cow dairy. And a dairy that size takes about 20 full-time workers.
Which in a lot of cases is more employees than a lot of their Main Street businesses employ.
With that kind of economic boost on the line, it's no wonder Nebraska has to compete with neighbors like South Dakota, Kansas, and Iowa on the dairy recruiting trail. California shouldn't worry about the Midwest poaching away its dairy industry. It's still the top dairy state. But Marty DeHoag says for him, Nebraska was a good move.
Yeah, I drive around here and see the fields of corn, fields of soybean and alfalfa. Everything's here, you know, and that's what you need.
One drawback, he was surrounded by dairies in California. Now he feels a little isolated.
Yeah, one buddy went to Idaho. A couple other dairymen from Northern California went to South Dakota, you know, Iowa.
And here you are in Nebraska.
And I came to Nebraska. I didn't know nobody.
The state is hoping that if their recruiting plan works, he won't stay lonely for long. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media, based in Kansas City, reports on farm and food issues in collaboration with public media stations across the Midwest, and in this case, with Valley Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on Valley Edition and talk to the CEO of Valley Children's Hospital. That's right. They're back to their old name that they hadn't used since 2002. But that's just the start of the changes at the Madera County facility. We'll talk about what it means for residents across the valley from Kern County to Merced and about the ongoing tensions between the hospital and a local physicians group. What does it mean for your kids and the rest of the community? That's all coming up straight ahead here on Valley Edition.
See when she's gone, it's foreign on this side, and I'll not leave my home again. There's no place to hide.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last week, the Valley's only pediatric hospital announced some big changes, starting with a new name. Children's Hospital Central California is now returning to the name it had from the 1950s through the early 2000s, Valley Children's Hospital. It's also making some other changes that could affect the care your children receive. Valley Children's CEO Todd Sunterpack joins us now on the phone. Mr. Sunterpack, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
It seems like the hospital has spent much of the last decade trying to train Valley residents to say the new name, Children's Hospital. Now you're going back to the original name. Why the change and why now?
Well, that's a great question, and I appreciate it. And I think it's really informed by the communities that we serve. They've never stopped referring to us as Valley Children's. It is certainly the name that has been cherished and trusted by families across the valley, millions of families, in fact, over our history since our inception. And in honoring them, we've chosen to both create Valley Children's Healthcare and return to the name Valley Children's Hospital.
You mentioned the Valley Children's Healthcare. This is a health network that you launched last week. Is this something entirely new, or is it a new name for the services you were already providing?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's a combination of the two. We have certainly been working in this direction for a number of years to create a network that will enhance access for families across the valley, up and down the valley, from Bakersfield to Stockton and in fact, over to the Central Coast for years now. And as we looked at how to better do that and fulfill a vision of not having any patient have to travel more than 30 minutes to reach Valley Children's Healthcare location, it became very clear that we needed to take additional steps, invest in a new way, in fact, in an unprecedented way, in the Valley, and thus Valley Children's Healthcare was born. But in the past 3 years in particular, we have been planning and have a series of investments, some of which we can talk about and some of which will be unveiled later this year or over the next 18 months, but all of which are focused on creating access to pediatric care, specialty care, and pediatric care closer to where a family lives, wherever they are in the Valley.
You mentioned Bakersfield. We have a number of listeners in Kern County on our station there. What is your strategy for serving the South Valley? Because that's sort of the one of the new things that you talked about last week.
Right. Well, we're actually, we'll be announcing shortly a partnership with one of the established pediatric practices in Bakersfield to create a location, an outpatient clinic location, that a number of our specialists will see patients out of right there in Bakersfield, which will obviously serve the surrounding communities. But in addition to that, we will be recruiting certain pediatric subspecialists that will live in the community. So they won't just travel from the main site to Bakersfield. They will, in fact, live in the community side by side and be dedicated. Their care will be dedicated there every day. We also have one of our affiliate physician groups that are very invested in the pediatric intensive care unit at Bakersfield Memorial Hospital, providing pediatric intensive care every day and have had for close to 2 years now. So those are a couple of ways that we'll be investing additionally in Bakersfield. And as I said, there are a couple of more ways that are even more substantial that we're working on that just aren't quite ready to be announced yet.
You mentioned that your presence extends from the North Valley to Kern County and even the Central Coast. Is it a challenge having that broad of a geographic area? What is that like?
I think it is a challenge in some ways, but it's one that we're very familiar with. And for a children's hospital, being a specialty provider, typically, it's one that children's hospitals are used to. There is always a need to get pediatric care closer to where families live. And I think that's a challenge anywhere there is a children's hospital. So while it's a challenge, it's one we're very familiar with, and we're taking steps through Valley Children's Healthcare to address that, to get the care closer to where families live. I think it's one that we're mindful of, but that will be overcome in the next decade. After all, we take care of about 250,000 children, and within a couple of years now, we're trending to take care of about 300,000 children per year coming from around the Valley. And there are about 1.2 million kids age 0 to 17 in the Valley. So you can see 1 in 4 to 5 children we will take care of with Valley Children's Healthcare, and our objective is to get that care closer to where the families live, because the sooner a patient can get to his or her care provider, the better the outcomes.
We're talking with Valley Children's CEO Todd Centerpack on our program today. You also announced what you called an expanded partnership with Stanford last week. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it means a number of things, not the least of which is really working together to innovate new care models, to make sure the right resources are in the right place at the right time that will give the best possible clinical outcome for a child. And I think beyond that, really blazing the trail to not just look at care in an episodic manner or upon an acute presentation, but with a focus on wellness. The ideal state would be that a child never needs to come to our Madera campus, and that a child can stay in his or her community close to his or her family with all the support that that entails and can live a healthier life. So our expanded partnership with Stanford Children's Health will both innovate new care models, but it will also have a focus in the coming years on how we enhance the health and well-being of children across the Valley. We're very excited about it. It's definitely not a sprint. It's a marathon. This will be many years' worth of work, but this is the work that we are here in the Valley to do.
There's a lot of change in your industry in California and beyond, as healthcare is a growing industry, but it's also one that is on an unprecedented era of change. We've seen other children's hospitals in California consolidate, like UCSF Benioff and Children's Hospital Oakland. Is that sort of relationship something that's in these discussions with Stanford?
That's a great question. I appreciate it. It is not. This is not a merger. This is a partnership. A collaborative one that will leverage the strength of both organizations and while keeping both cultures distinct but allow for the collaboration of the clinical teams to, as I said, innovate new care models and eventually really focus on wellness and improving the health and well-being of kids across the Valley, and eventually our learnings will be shared with other organizations. But it is not quite the same as the Oakland Children's and UCSF Benioff relationship, because I understand, and I'm certainly not an expert in the exact legal relationship, but as I understand it, UCSF has become the sole corporate member of Oakland Children, so it's different. Our governance, we are still a freestanding organization, will continue to be as Stanford Children's Health is, and this is really about a partnering in partnership versus a merger.
A lot of the change that's going on in the healthcare industry is brought about by the Affordable Care Act. We're right now at just about the one-year anniversary of the expansion of coverage under the ACA. It's also creating change at hospitals in the way that hospitals operate and physicians groups operate. What kind of pressures are independent hospitals facing, children's hospitals facing, and how is this first year of the expansion of coverage affecting something like Valley Children's?
Yeah. So I think that we're very blessed in the state of California that the citizens of California have committed over many decades now to take some very strong and consistent moves to make sure that any child that's in the state of California has some form of coverage. And as I said, we're very blessed that that is the commitment of the citizens of California. And so as the ACA applies to providing new coverage for children, we have not seen the same type of thing that many adult providers see with new members that are covered for the first time. Because, as I said, in the state of California, almost all children have some form of coverage. And that's been a great thing for kids and something that I think we should all be proud of. But what we have seen is quite a bit of pressure on revenues. So there is a lot of discourse in healthcare policy circles, certainly in the provider community, and with payers about the growing costs of healthcare have got to either stall or be reduced, and that the economics of healthcare in America are such that it is probably not sustainable to continue to grow it in the way that it has over the last several decades. And so there's a lot of additional focus, dialogue, as I said, discourse about how we innovate care in a way that ensures that we provide the best possible clinical outcome. But while we reduce cost and slow the ongoing growth of healthcare costs, and I personally think that that's a good thing, and I think we need to do that work. We need to we need to innovate. We need to standardize our care. We need to reduce variability and take waste out as a result of that reduction of variability. And again, that's much more about a marathon and multi-year approach than it is sprinting to a particular answer, because that innovation and care needs to happen across disciplines and in a way that is always mindful of the patient. So it can never happen in a way that the patient receives any type of care that's anything other than the standard of care or enhancing the clinical outcome. And that's a challenge. And I think that's a challenge industry-wide, but I think as an industry, we're up for the challenge, and I think that that has to be our work. And I think, you know, our fellow citizens deserve it.
We're talking with Todd Sunterpak, Valley Children's CEO. There's been a lot of talk in the community lately about the relationship between your hospital and one of the Valley's largest physicians groups, Sante Community Physicians. Why did you make the decision to sever that relationship and stop the referrals from their doctors?
Well, I think that we've commented on that quite a lot. And I don't have anything new to add today. I'd be happy to come back on and speak to that when we do have more to add. And what I will say, though, is we have been and remain focused on enhancing access to the kids around the Valley and taking all steps that are necessary to ensure that this asset of the Valley for the Valley is here for another 60 years and beyond. And any decision we make, any decision that our Board of Trustees takes is focused on preserving this asset for the children and families of the Valley for the next 60 years.
You talk about preserving that asset, and that is certainly a concern for many here in the Valley. There's concern about duplication of services. Is there going to be a rivalry here? Can the Valley, in your view, support two facilities that are providing similar services?
I think that every healthcare organization has to be true to their mission. And certainly, as I've described, our trustees, we are a standalone organization. We're the only organization in the Valley that is purely dedicated to providing pediatric care. And that's what we're focused on. I think other organizations and their leadership at the governance level have to make the decisions that they feel best meet their mission and their purpose for being. And so it's really not appropriate for me to interpret another organization's mission. I think only the people that are leading it at the governance level can do that. But certainly, we at Valley Children's Healthcare are focused on ensuring that there are the appropriate pediatric specialists to care for the needs of kids up and down the Valley. And as I said earlier, with a goal, and hopefully not in the too distant future, although I do think it'll be, as I've said, a little bit of a marathon and not a sprint, but we want to focus on taking care of all the kids in the Valley and enhancing access in a way that's sustainable. And that means they only have to drive no more than 30 minutes to reach Valley Children's Healthcare.
You mentioned, again, preserving that resource, and that is a core of your board's mission and your vision for the hospital moving forward. How concerned are you, and what does the loss or potential loss of specialists from your physicians groups, specialty medical group, how does that affect your ability to operate your hospital? Because as has been documented in the media locally, Sante and their partner community have been recruiting away from your group. How does that affect your ability to function and operate a hospital? Because I understand there are rules and things that you have to have the staffing for.
Well, I might have gotten a little bit distracted through the course of your question, but let me maybe try and refocus to, I think it's important to note that Valley Children's has enjoyed the overwhelming support of the communities that we serve across the Valley for over 60 years. And we are a very careful organization and steward of that trust and that investment. And we, as a result, are fairly conservative and I think are well positioned now in the coming 3 to 5 years to, as I said earlier, invest in the communities that we serve across the Valley in a way that's both responsible and sustainable. And I think it would be, in today's world, I think it would be naive to assume that there won't be, in various areas some additional or enhanced competition. And I think that that's one of the great things about America. So I think that while some may be concerned, I also think that we are the trusted brand and the trusted group of providers and clinical experts for kids for every Valley community, and will continue to be based upon our clinical outcomes, based upon our creating additional access for kids in their communities and innovating new care models, as I've said, and also taking the focus on wellness to a new level. The only other clarification I would make is we've lost no doctors from our affiliate specialty medical group, which is one thing I think you mentioned a minute ago. But I really think that the future is bright for Valley Children's Healthcare, Valley Children's Hospital, and for the communities we serve, and that the health and well-being of children will be better served by our organization than it ever has been before.
But before we go, how would you characterize your relationship with community hospitals at this point?
Honestly, I've said as much as I care to say about that today. As I said, when we have more to say about it, we'll be in touch. We'll be happy to come back on.
All right. Valley Children's CEO Todd Sunterpack joining us today, talking about their new Valley Children's Healthcare Network and the new name of the hospital, reverting back to its old familiar name that many Valley families have come to trust over the years. Todd Sunterpack, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Valley Edition. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with a special in-studio musical guest. Eva Scow and The Experience join us. They're performing this coming Sunday for the annual Crescent Concert at Fulton 55. We'll get an in-studio treat that's on the way here on Valley Edition straight ahead.
. 2014 has been a year of powerful stories from across the globe to here at home.
The Picayune Rancheria of the Chukchansi Indians is split into three factions over family conflicts that have stewed for generations. And now the fight has escalated into the alleged loss of millions of dollars, missing audit, and the control of the tribe's main source of income.
Get my vehicle up here now.
This is a temple.
Tell them they need it up here now.
Hi, this is Joe Moore, host of Valley Edition. Our Valley Public Radio news team brought you local stories from across our region this year. Some of the stories were powerful, like the families in Arvin who were forced out of their homes for months after a toxic gas leak.
They came to the house, told everybody they had evacuated within an hour. And they said, okay, you have to grab whatever you can, approximately for 7 days. We're evacuating everybody because we are in danger of explosion.
Others were uplifting, like the story of the young Visalia woman who started her own opera company to bring Valley audiences both the classics and new ideas, like the fusion of opera and mariachi.
I feel like it's a very good marriage, simply because we can. We live in the Valley, and we are open to creating new things here.
Of course, no one knows what stories 2015 will bring, but with your support of Valley Public Radio, we'll be there to cover them. Make a tax-deductible year-end gift today at kvpr.org and help FM89 bring the stories of the Valley to life.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Joining us in our studio now, we have a special musical treat for our Valley Edition listeners. Jazz and world music mandolinist Eva Scow is with us, together with portions of her band, The Experience. Eva, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
You're holding your annual Crescent Concert that is taking place Sunday at Fulton 55, Sunday evening, with a couple of other groups, including a band called Boca de Rio and also another artist, Sarah Cabral. We'll hear something from Sarah in a little bit, but first of all, tell me about the Crescent Concert.
Yeah, it's a concert that I curate every year that celebrates musical diversity by bringing groups of different genres together for one night of just, you know, fun and really great sounds. I've always loved blending styles and borrowing ideas from different genres, so this was a way to have a unique offering for the people of Fresno and also for us as musicians to be challenged to create something really exciting and just different than what we've been playing the rest of the year.
You talk about blending styles and influences. That really sort of sums up your musical background.
Yeah.
You started out playing folk music, then you discovered Brazilian and then jazz. How did you get to be where you are today? Because it's a really interesting mix, as we'll hear live in our studio in a moment.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how it happened, but every time I heard a new style when I was younger, I just fell in love with it, and I found something to hold on to and grasp onto and try to learn as much as I could about that style, whether it was the rhythm. You know, Brazilian music, it's very rhythmic, and so I just really felt, you know, compelled by that rhythm. In classical music, it's the melodies and the technique, and folk music, it's just the beautiful way that people play that style, the little subtleties in every style of music is what really inspires me.
What is it about the mandolin? Because you also play the violin and other instruments as well, but the mandolin is sort of what you're known for.
Yeah.
What was it about that instrument that drew your attention and then held your attention through all these different styles, through all these different genres?
The mandolin, it's such a unique instrument. Every time I hear somebody else play it, I love it in any different style. I mean, it's prevalent in so many different cultures around the world, which to me says it's very diverse. Now, maybe not everybody, you know, loves the sound of the mandolin, but I feel it's one of those instruments that, for me personally, I'm really able to express myself. The violin is an incredible instrument. The piano is an incredible instrument. But for whatever reason, I really enjoy playing the mandolin and getting all the different sounds out of it. Obviously, I play electric in some groups. I play solely acoustic in other groups, so there's a lot of different sounds that can come out of it.
You've had the opportunity to work with some great musicians and some great mentors.
Yeah.
How much does somebody like Mike Marshall or some of the other great mandolinists that you've been able to work with, how much have they influenced your approach? Again, because I think about them and their works, and they also sort of have that cross-genre, cross-boundary thing going on in their music, and you've kind of picked up on that.
Yeah, I've been totally inspired by people like Mike, and by the way, I have to commend you for having a Nickel Creek song on your
Noticed we had two mandolins. I had Peter Ostrushko earlier, actually.
Oh, yeah. I love Peter as well. But I was standing here, and I heard Nickel Creek, and I've had the pleasure of meeting Chris Thiele and playing with him on a couple of different occasions. So people like him and Mike and Peter, and the list goes on. You know, from all over the world, I've been lucky to meet people from all over the world and that play mandolin. And, yeah, just watching them play is one of the – it's just so incredible how everyone's approach is a little bit different, and all the different sounds that they pull out of their instruments, depending on the styles, is really cool.
Now we're going to hear something in just a bit with your band or portions of your band that are here, as Pat Olvera and Mike Taylor are joining us in the studio. You're going to play a Brazilian number. What is it about Brazilian music? What's the first thing you think about when you think the music of Brazil that draws you in and has held your attention and love for so long?
Oh, man, it's so hard for me to say one thing. I mean, a samba rhythm is like really, really infectious and just a feel-good. You know, it's like the music of Brazil is always about being happy. Even if it's about something that's extremely sad, they still find a way to, like, find the beauty in it. So whether it's the harmony from, like, Brazilian jazz, like from Antonio Carlos Jobim, or more country folk music like choro music. I've always just loved the melodies, the harmonies, and the rhythm. So we're going to play a song by a guitarist named João Bosco, and this is a samba.
Well, let's go ahead and listen to this now. Evascau and the Experience here on Valley Edition at Valley Public Radio. They're performing at the Crescent Concert this Sunday, 7 p.m. at Fulton 55. The Experience here on Valley Public Radio. Thank you. Evascow and the experience here at Valley Public Radio today, live in the Bonner Performing Arts Studio. Here on our program today, as they're performing the tune Boca de Rio. The Crescent Concert is coming up on Sunday at 7 p.m. at Fulton 55. Evascow mandolin is Pat Olvera on bass and Mike Taylor guitar. This band is really special. How long have you been working together as a unit?
The experience has been together for about 5 years now, and one of our members who's not here today is a great drummer and also our lead vocalist named Ray Moore. And over the years we've explored a little bit of Brazilian, obviously a lot of soul and funk and R&B, which is another style of music that we really identify with. So on Sunday we'll be playing anything from some George Benson, some great oldies classics, R&B, soul funk classics, to a little bit more contemporary jazz style. And then obviously Boca de Rio and Sarah will have that whole Latin Brazilian aspect and covered as well. So it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Let's talk about Sarah that's coming up. I misidentified the tune Boca de Rio.
Oh, that's okay.
The group.
That's okay.
That's the group that's coming up, not the tune that you were playing.
Yeah, no worries.
But let's talk about Sarah, because we have a selection that we'll hear from here. Tell us about Sarah Cabral.
Yeah, Sarah is a real special vocalist. She's from the southern part of Brazil, and she's been living in the Bay Area for about 11 years and working with some really great mentors up there, Brazilian jazz artists, at part of the jazz school up in Berkeley, which is a really great scene. And we met her a few years ago and connected with her and started playing all this new repertoire of Brazilian music that I had never played before. And she just recently finished her first album, which we'll hear a cut from. And the cut is actually a really great song written by Antonio Carlos Jobim. Some of you might recognize it, but this is our kind of version of this song called Chovendo na Roseira.
We only have a few minutes left, so let's go ahead and listen to a selection now, a portion of that piece right now. Again, Sarah Cabral here on Valley Public Radio.
É bem, sim.
Só da rosa, mas não cheira a frescura das gotas úmidas, que é de Luísa, Pet e Paulinho, que é de João, que é de ninguém. Pétalas de rosas carregadas pelo vento, um amor tão puro carregou meu pensamento. Passeando no molhado, adivinhou a primavera. Olha, que chuva boa, prazenteira, que vem molhar minha roseira. Chuva boa, criadeira, que molha a terra, que enche o rio, que limpa o céu.
Been listening to Sarah Cabral, and she's coming up performing in Fresno on Sunday evening at 7 p.m. at Fulton 55 as part of Evascow's Crescent Concert, an annual event that takes place every December. Evascow and the experience with us here in studio. Boca de Rio, tell us about the band.
Boca de Rio is another great band that I've recently connected with. They've been playing out of the San Francisco Bay Area for the last 15 years, and it features a guitarist, vocalist, and the songwriter, Kevin Welch, who lived in Brazil for many years and just has a really great songwriting ability to blend Brazilian styles and influences with American pop music and folk music. And the other person that's featured is an incredible master percussionist from northern Brazil named Alex Calatayuji. And he plays pandeiro, which is something similar to a tambourine. And it sounds like a full, marching band when he plays. It's just incredible. It's out of this little drum, but it's a very energetic band, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
We'll be looking forward to it again. It's the Crescent Concert, 7 p.m. at Fulton 55, Eviscau, and The Experience. Thank you so much for joining us
today. Thank you for having me.
And we are looking forward to that performance. That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. Follow us on Twitter. We're @kvpr. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Diana Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.